The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Cochran, Judge Klapacki, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding.
Good morning, everybody. I know you're pros by now at remote oral arguments, but just as a reminder, if at any point you're having trouble hearing us, let us know and we will do likewise and figure things out. There will be an audio recording available after. And so for the purposes of the record, if you will introduce yourself at the start of your oral argument, and if you're ready to go, we can call the case and get started. Marshall, do you want to call the case?
Calling case number A20-1035. State of Minnesota, respondent versus Quentin Pierre Arnold, appellant.
All right, Mr. Whitlock, you have 15 minutes, and as you know, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So introduce yourself and proceed when you're ready.
Looks like
you
he's
are
muted. I forget every time we get kicked out of the big room, we have to reestablish everything. I apologize. Good morning. If it pleases the court and counsel, my name is Ira Whitlock. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Mr. Arnold, and I am obviously beginning my argument. I know that the court has reviewed the briefs and the materials, and so I will try not to mimic exactly what I placed in my briefs, but I do believe this matter should be reversed and remanded and that Mr. Arnold deserves a new trial. The most significant issue, Your Honor, is the insufficiency of evidence in this case. Mr. Arnold was convicted of a promoting prostitution case where no one came in and said, this is my pimp, this is the guy who promoted me, and I am the victim in this case. Obviously, this was a circumstantial case, which the state admits, and you know, I plan to attack their arguments pretty vigorously, and I will, of course, address any questions that the court has.
So with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, in your brief, you say the main reason the evidence is insufficient is none of the alleged victims testified to appellant being their pimp or directing their actions. And you just mentioned that a minute ago, too. So I'm wondering, is it your view then that that evidence is required in order for there to be sufficient evidence to convict your client? And if so, is there any case law to support that position?
Well, that is not my position, Your Honor. But in this particular case, the state didn't do enough to establish even a circumstantial case. To admit the evidence based off the testimony of a John, I certainly don't want to be disparaging toward counsel, who I know is a licensed attorney, but since the state mentioned his name in the briefs multiple times, Mr. Marsden was a compromised witness. I would ask this court to take judicial notice of. He had the incentive of wanting to maintain his bar card, as well as after admitting that he was addicted to this lifestyle, that he entertained multiple prostitutes. Part of my argument is that he was more of an accomplice in this case than he was anything else. Remember, some of his testimony was that one of the prostitutes in this case came to him and said, I need you to protect me because I don't want to go with this guy.
Well, technically, he wasn't a co-conspirator because he couldn't be charged with this offense, could he?
Your Honor,
obviously. So he couldn't be an accomplice.
Your Honor, obviously, I understand the state's position on that, and I understand their argument in their brief. I disagree with that position, Your Honor, and the law changes all of the time. Here is an individual who was only approached that on the eve of trial and ultimately gave corroborating evidence or gave evidence against the defendant when the state knew that they didn't have alleged victims to come in and testify in court. Don't forget his identification of my client.
Seems to me that all of these things may go to his credibility, and that was before the jury, and the jury was able to, or should be able to, make those credibility determinations, shouldn't it?
Well, I think that's for this court to decide. I don't believe that this...
You mean we should decide the credibility of that witness?
I think the state I think this court has to decide whether or not the jury had enough to establish this, to establish or corroborate his evidence. There was no witnesses to corroborate his information. There was no, the DK didn't come in.
Wait, Mr. Whitlock, really what you're asking us to do is reweigh the evidence, correct? Because we have to assume that the jury believed the testimony favorable to the verdict, and then we are required to ignore the other. So help us out here in understanding your argument.
I'll help you out, Your Honor. This court has to understand the nuances of this. I'm claiming both ineffective assistance of counsel and the fact that the evidence is insufficient. What I'm saying, Your Honor, Your Honors, is that this witness identified my client in the courtroom. He couldn't identify my client outside of the courtroom. He picked this different individual. So for the state to claim that this was not an in-court identification and wasn't unnecessarily suggestive it goes against the Constitution and the case law and everything else. This individual came in and said, oh, I remember him because of his gold teeth. And I only saw him once or maybe twice, but yeah, he connected me with a young lady who said she didn't want to be with them. They took the information that, again, was hearsay, not corroborated, not confirmed by the testimony of DK, to say that she was scared of him and she wanted another pimp, who was Brian Marsden, to take care of her because she didn't want to go with my client. That in and of itself rises to a level where this court has to decide whether the jury had enough information to establish credibility of Brian Marsden. There was no corroboration.
But isn't there a lot of circumstantial evidence, though? I mean, from the cell phones that they found in his car, but isn't there enough circumstantial evidence so that even if this in-court identification was in error, that it's, maybe harmless error?
And one of the reasons I placed the burden on this court, as opposed to my client, who had no burden to prove himself, innocent. It's difficult to prove a negative. My client didn't have a phone in his name. He didn't have a car in his name. He didn't have a hotel room in his name. Remember, his mother had the hotel room in her name on the night that he was found near the hotel, the American Inn. She wasn't even called as a witness to say, yeah, my son is a pimp and I rented the room for him to have prostitutes and make money that night. In fact, much of my client's conviction is based off the reputation of his family as pimps in the community. There was not evidence established to show that my client was a pimp in any way, that he promoted prostitution in any way. In fact, one of the major things that goes against that argument is that while my client was in jail and could not have posted an ad for DK or anyone else, shows that she was promoting herself and had another pimp who was her promoter. But the state wants to disregard that evidence when my client was in custody and she was still posting ads.
Is the time that she was posting ads, does that post-date the time that is at issue with regard to his conviction, that time period?
I apologize. Part of the court's argument is that that's outside of the time limit. What I'm saying is that if this court reviews all of the evidence and understands that the defendant does not have to prove his innocence per the Constitution and has a right to confront his accusers per Crawford and the constitutional Sixth Amendment rights, even with that being outside of the timeline, respectfully, Your Honor, that it shows that someone else was promoting her. That goes to some of my information, some of my argument about the insufficiency, ineffectiveness of counsel. Counsel didn't present a case and didn't do the investigation. At some point, counsel argued evidence in his opening statement that the court would not allow him to argue in his closing argument. That in and of itself was deficient. That prejudiced Mr. Arnold, the appellant in this case.
Do you think you've established a sufficient record on the insufficiency of counsel? Or do you think it would be appropriate that would be left for another day?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I know it's very difficult to prove insufficiency of counsel. And basically they put the burden on the defendant or in this case, the appellant to bring in an expert to say a colleague is in some way deficient. Without an expert witness to say that counsel was deficient, my client is left waffling in the wind. It was sort of like—
Well, the other issue is we haven't heard from his attorney, so that we don't know what the attorney's thinking was. That directed what he did and didn't do. And that's normally what we get to observe after post-conviction. Don't you think it's appropriate that be done there rather than here?
Certainly an argument can be made anytime there's an appeal that a person could have went back into court on a post-conviction motion to argue those deficiencies and to establish a record. What I'm saying is counsel's opening argument is so glaring of the fact that he said these women would not testify, these alleged victims would not testify, and before he had a ruling from the court that he would be allowed to engage in that activity or to establish that in any way through evidence and or a closing argument. That in and of itself, without an expert witness testifying that he was ineffective.
Earlier, Judge Cochran asked you if there was any case law that supported the proposition that in a situation like this, all three of the victims would have to testify. And I don't recall that you gave a response. And my own observation is I'm not aware of any case law that would require the victims to testify as a matter of law. Do you have any case of that kind?
I don't. And I apologize if the court feels like I didn't answer that question. I thought I answered it by saying, well, I'll answer it this way. We all know that both the state and the defense can call witnesses, thus ineffective assistance of counsel. It seems to me that the defense attorney, if he did any investigation, made a decision that he would not call these witnesses that were alleged to be close, cohorts with my client, the appellant. And these witnesses could have came in and said they were not pimped by him. No witnesses were called. His mother was not called. The hotel room was in her name. The vehicle my client was stopped in was in his sister's name. She wasn't called as a witness. None of these young ladies were called as a witness. And Brian Marsden was basically used as the state star witness, even though he had only met my client on one real occasion. He alleges that it might have been two. And then he identifies them in court improperly based on an unnecessarily suggestive identification based on gold teeth. So there is no case law that says certain witnesses have to testify. That's one of the reasons the judge ruled that my client couldn't, my client's counsel at the time could not argue that in his closing argument, that those witnesses did not testify.
Because he could have subpoenaed those witnesses. He could have had them testify if he wanted to.
Absolutely. Right? And that's why he was ineffective, Your Honor. And that's why
we don't know why he didn't call those witnesses. Maybe he had a very good reason not to call those witnesses.
Your Honor, this case was too important to my client and his life for those witnesses not to be called. If those witnesses, if the state's argument is correct and my client had those witnesses under their thumb, most likely those witnesses would have came in and said he was not their pimp. Why not call those witnesses? And we know that the prostitutes won't be charged with crimes if they're allegedly under the thumb of a pimp, just like you argued about Brian Marsden not being a co-conspirator. I believe Brian Marsden is a co-conspirator. He was a potential pimp. He was a potential third-party perpetrator, despite the fact that the law says, well, we don't want to call, we don't want to prosecute the Johns because we want them to be witnesses for us when we want to prosecute a real pimp. Nothing has established that my client was a pimp or promoted prostitution. Nothing also, was in his...
Earlier you mentioned that the defendant doesn't need to show his innocence, and you're absolutely correct in that. But the state did present evidence, circumstantial evidence, which Judge Siegel referenced, that in the form of text messages and Facebook messages, I believe. And on page 17 of respondent's brief, there's a quote from appellant saying to DK, I'm trying to find you a room in Bloomington. I need you to make more money. I know you can. So given that type of evidence and the other evidence, similar evidence showing his involvement, why is the circumstantial evidence not sufficient to support the jury's verdict?
I know my time has elapsed, but I will answer the court's question this in this way. I'm sure the court is not requiring me and or my client to prove that he was the individual behind the text messages that no one knows who sent. In fact, there were females who owned the phones who were also promoting prostitution and should have been called, should have been presented as third party perpetrators, a female who owned the phone. And there's evidence of her texting these young ladies on prior situations, and that's a part of the record. And that's what I would say, that's why I would say this is, that's not definitive proof of establishing circumstantial evidence sufficient to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt, or sufficient evidence in this case. I apologize.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Whitlock. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Cornell, is that the right way to say your name?
It
Cornell?
Is.
Great, excellent, all right. And please introduce yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because sufficient evidence supports appellant's convictions for promoting the prostitution of all three victims in this case. The district court did not make evidentiary rulings warranting reversal, and appellant received effective assistance of counsel at trial. And based on the court's questions so far today, I will keep my argument brief, but I'd like to clarify a few things that counsel had said during his argument in chief. And then I'm happy to address any questions or concerns the court has about the record or any of the three issues in this case. First, I'd like to note that the way respondent describes his challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence claim disregards the standard of review on this matter, as several on this panel have pointed out already. This court does not reweigh evidence, does not rejudge credibility. It defers that the jury accepted the state's evidence and rejected evidence to the contrary when you're reviewing even a heightened circumstantial evidence, a heightened scrutiny case such as this. The second point I'd like to make is that counsel refers to Mr. Marsden's quote identification on the stand as both positive and then not positive. And the correct answer to that based on the record is there was no positive identification either in the photo lineup or at trial when Mr. Marsden was on the stand. And counsel also has briefly mentioned, I think I heard this correctly, was that Mr. Marsden's partial identification, I guess you could say, on the stand was unnecessarily suggestive. And I'm not sure I heard that correctly, but that is not an argument to be made. Unnecessarily suggestive refers to a photo lineup and whether that photo lineup was unnecessarily suggestive as it was presented to the person viewing the photos. And in this case, there is no record of that. This was a sequential photo lineup. There's no record that that was unnecessarily suggestive. And even if it was, there was no positive identification at the time Mr. Marsden viewed the photo lineup. Third, appellant asserts that the state presented evidence of appellant's family having a reputation for being a family who promotes prostitution in the area. This is the first time hearing of that. There's no evidence in the record regarding that.
And so going back to the circumstances proof, does the state's evidence prove that these phones from which the text messages that are at issue belong to appellant?
They do for several reasons. First, just to clarify, there were three cell phones found on appellant, either in his pocket or in the car that he was driving, that were confiscated at the time of his arrest. So the two phones that were actually able to be reviewed using Cellebrite technology, as the investigators testified in this case, show that appellant was the user of these phones. The phones also listed the phone numbers. So from the phones, we know what the phone numbers are and how that phone number interacted with others. So from context, you know that when the user of a phone sends masses of text messages saying, yo, this is QP, QP new number, this, that, and the other, referring to people that he knows in relations that are appropriate for this particular appellant to be communicating with and interacting with. So from context, you certainly know it's his phones. I hope that answers your question. There's more to the record as well. But certainly from context, they were found on his person. There was no record to the contrary that they weren't his cell phones. And I'd like to finally echo what Judge Klopaki said as well about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The appropriate way that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel could have been addressed is to stay this appeal, to pursue post-conviction relief where you can establish that record, because it is an appellant's burden to prove ineffective assistance of counsel, and those claims of ineffective assistance of counsel cannot be conjecture or speculation. You need some basis to overcome the presumption that someone did receive effective assistance of counsel. There's no record of that in this case. And so that issue, this court should reject on appeal. It's not postured appropriately, and there is no record for this court to judge.
So with regard to that issue, I think there is at least one piece of it that we could address, which is the argument relating to counsel's statement I believe it was in his opening statement, counsel stated, what the prosecutor told you is pretty much accurate. Mm-hmm. And appellant argues that that was an admission of guilt. So can you please address that argument and explain why that does not amount to an admission of guilt when you contend that the circumstances proved are sufficient to, you know, support the jury's verdict?
I can, and I'm just flipping to my page so I can see the actual quote that I included.
Yeah, I think it's on page 44 of your brief.
Thank you. Yeah. Lengthy brief, a lot of single space font. I apologize for that to the panel. And what Judge Cochran, you said was correct when appellant's trial counsel said, members of the jury, what the prosecutor told you is pretty much accurate. That cannot be read in isolation. No review of any opening or closing statement can be viewed line by line and have some ruling be dispositive about a particular oral argument just based on one sentence. You look at it as a whole. So the following sentence says, but, and grammatically speaking, that could have been a comma at the end of accurate, continuing on with but as a lowercase letter. But so within the context, what the attorney is essentially arguing is what the prosecutor says he's going to show that, but the following line says that's still not enough. There's lacking here, here, and here. Here's where reasonable doubt is going to come in. So there's no way from the text of that word, or excuse me, the text of that single sentence in trial counsel's opening statement, or within the context of the following statements that can be so prejudicial as to require reversal in this case. That argument fails.
But he also does refer to the fact that the three witnesses, the three subjects, would not be coming to the witness stand, which I assume you would agree was inappropriate.
Yes, I do. I do agree that's inappropriate. The trial court thought that was inappropriate. Opposing counsel, the prosecutor in this case, thought it was inappropriate. The prosecutor in this case, the record shows that the prosecutor chose not to object at the time because he had a lot of respect for the trial counsel, didn't want to interrupt the proceedings. There's several reasons to not object. But in this particular case, that cannot be an error warranting reversal. The addition of that line, let me start over. The jury does not know why that line is inappropriate. So the substantial effect on the jury's verdict is non-existent. The jury doesn't know that that's an inappropriate argument, and they don't know that they're supposed to be judging a trial counsel's argument as evidence. They are explicitly instructed what the attorneys say are not evidence. So there's no prejudice, certainly in that statement either, in counsel's opening. And I'll note that that was isolated to opening. It was not mentioned in closing.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you. And I'm happy to entertain any other questions about the record or any of appellant's arguments. Otherwise, respondent rests on its brief, and we request that this court affirm.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you. And Mr. Whitlock, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Looks like the timer is up. So whenever you're ready, proceed.
Thank you. I am, as usual, scribbling notes as arguments are happening. I do want to say that the court's question to counsel, the court's questions are pertinent. The court talked, asked counsel about the phones. None of the phones were established to be owned by my client. In fact, the state acknowledges and the evidence shows that at least two of the phones were not on my client's person and were in the vehicle, a vehicle not owned by him, not in his name. And so there's no evidence that this young lady who was also in contact with these alleged prostitutes, you know, obviously this court could say alleged victims, in terms of promoting them or helping them get hotel rooms or whatever. And so these phones should not be just assumed to be connected to my client because a police officer said the phone was ringing off the hook. It was buzzing while we were arresting him. So we picked the phone up and assumed it was someone calling him. That's insufficient. No evidence established it. No witness established it. No witness came in and said, this was my pimp's number and I called him at this number. And I've had plenty of these cases in the past where that evidence was presented and established clearly. It was not done so here, and the evidence is insufficient. So in a vehicle not his, phones not in his name, hotel rooms in other people's name, the court's questions about counsel's admissions on behalf of my client, to say that is not a constitutional violation of my client's right to effective assistance of counsel is, with all due respect, is an insufficient argument. I don't want to be flamboyant and say ridiculous or whatever, but certainly for an attorney to stand up and know the rules of court, say witnesses are not coming in when he had the ability to contact these witnesses, subpoena these witnesses. Don't forget, the state says the reason the witnesses didn't come in was because they were my client's prostitutes. So if you want to take the state's argument in the light most favorable to them, then that means defense counsel had access to these witnesses who could have came in and said he wasn't their pimp. So to whitewash the fact that he would stand up and say, this is a bad case, it's ugly. You won't like the evidence that you're gonna hear. You won't like the information you're gonna hear. Basically saying, yeah, my client's a bad guy, but the state's not gonna be able to prove it. That is egregious, and my client deserves better. And he deserved better counsel and more sufficient counsel. He deserved effective assistance of counsel, with all due respect to my colleague. And then, with all due respect to my colleague here today, she says, well, the jury didn't know that they were supposed to be weighing that information. Well, they heard it and they did weigh it. Defense counsel stood up and admitted it and then said, well, the state knew it was an error, but they didn't object because they were friends and he respected counsel. I don't know if they're having lunch or coffee or whatever. And I've been practicing over 25 years. I have colleagues in the business on both sides. So I don't mind counsel having, one counsel having respect for another. But if you don't want the case to come back on appeal, you make an objection at that point. Counsel can't have it both ways to not object in the opening and say, okay, I set this guy up because he's not going to be able to argue that in his closing.
Mr. Whitlock, if I could just interrupt for a minute. I think the timer was set for 5 hours instead of 5 minutes. I just wanted to make sure you knew. You have about a minute left.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
No, you still have a minute left. So go ahead.
I see 4:55 available and I'm thinking this thing is not moving here.
I know. It occurred to me as well. So at any rate, but you still have at least a full minute. From 4:55:30 to whatever. So go ahead. I just wanted to bring that up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. And I will finish with this. Ineffective assistance of counsel is not my strongest argument. Insufficiency of evidence is, but for my colleague to claim in that this was not in some way significant for counsel to make these admissions and then for the state not to object to something that they knew was wrong. As officers of the court, both the judge and the prosecutors are ministers of justice and have a responsibility to make sure my client's rights are vindicated, properly vindicated, even if counsel is not doing his or her job, in this case, his job. And so it was highly prejudicial to my client to present that statement and to make admissions about, yeah, my guy's a bad guy and you're not gonna like him, but the state's not gonna be able to prove it. That's too flip. That's too loose. I'm not sure what time I have left, but thank
you. I think you're out. So if you're, are you done?
I thank the court for your time.
Great. No, and we apologize for the timer issue.
I'd like to have 5 hours though, Your Honor, to argue. I mean, my family tells me they want to cut me off all the time. So I need the 5 hours.
Oh, well, this panel might disagree, but all right. Thank you both for your arguments on this case. It is now submitted. Very helpful. So thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.